Good evening, this is Open Book. I'm Richard Wynnum. My guest this evening is Rollo Romig. Born and brought up in Detroit, Rollo Romig is the author of I Am on the Hit List, the story of the assassination of an investigative journalist, Gauri Lankesh, who edited and published a newspaper in her native Bangalore in South India. But more than documenting the life and abrupt death of Gauri Lankesh, the book traces the rise of the right-wing autocracy in India under the Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, a charismatic populist politician a la Donald Trump. Modi is described in the book as a majoritarian strongman who never apologizes. Rollo Romig is married to a woman from Bangalore. As a result, the city has become his second home. He's been reporting on South India, mostly for the New York Times Magazine, since 2013. He is a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for the book I Am on the Hit List. My understanding is that you grew up in Detroit?
That's right. Yeah. I just went back for the first time in about 20 years, so that was lovely. But yeah, born and raised in Detroit.
So forgive me, but how did you come to meet your wife? She is an Indian citizen?
Yeah,
she was. India?
She was until
An
recently,
immigrant?
Yeah. And she was born and raised there. She was born and raised in Kerala. But we met in New York City.
Oh, okay.
She came here for grad school and stuck around.
How did you assay the cultural differences between you? And I guess the same question could be given to her. There is no while. I would think that all the assumptions are so different one to the other.
Well, it's true, you know, and there's a lot to navigate. But I kind of have a theory that every family is its own culture. And so really, really everyone has to navigate this stuff. And then often there's a lot more commonalities than you expect, you know, beyond just kind of the obvious things. So I don't know. I think every marriage has a lot of work to do on cultural differences.
Well, I guess I can relate to that. My wife is from the Midwest.
Right. So there you go. Is she in the Midwest is she from?
It's complicated. She grew up in a number of different places, but I think if you were to try to pin her down, it'd probably be Missouri. Her father is originally from Tennessee.
Yeah.
Her mom is from, I think it's Idaho.
Yeah.
She's from one of the western states, anyway.
Yeah.
But she comes from a big family, and she came of age in St. Louis, and so I think that's how she identifies, you know.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. And where are you from originally?
South London. From I grew up in Croydon, and went to school there. Which kind of sort of leads into your book, in as much as the way you write about. And I'm curious, do people living in the city call it Bangaluru?
It depends. You hear both, you know. I mean, when speaking in English, I find people tend to stick to Bangalore, which is kind of the old. Well, it's always been Bengaluru to people who speak Kannada, and then but they officially changed the name from Bangalore to Bengaluru. And but you know, as with a lot of Indian cities, the change hasn't totally stuck. I decided to stick with the spelling Bangalore just because it's an English language book, and that tends to be how English speakers still refer to it.
Right, and that's I know Bangalore, you know.
Yeah,
I know the name. I know
well, there's that
about
too.
It, but as I said, we were in southern India, And in the brief time that I was there, I think I understand when people say that people in the south are very different from people in the north of India. We found people there, they're beautiful, they're sweet, they're very welcoming, they're very kind. But I've also eaten in Indian restaurants that were clearly run by northern Indians, and it's a different attitude. It's a bit like the difference between New Yorkers and people from Atlanta, you know.
Anyway, that's not even going to get into all the huge cultural differences across the South. You know, each state has its own language, completely different cuisines, cinemas, all this stuff.
Now then, that does beg the question, how does one person rule over such a diverse and enormous country? I mean, how many people is it? Half a billion, is that right?
Oh, it's more. It's over a billion. I think it's 1.2 billion at this point. So it crossed the threshold as the most populous country in the world within the past couple of years. And no, it's actually kind of a delightful mystery how India has managed to hang together so long. Like, we're so used to independent India existing in this vast pluralist form. This conglomeration of so many different cultures and languages and such a big geography that it seems obvious, but when India got its independence, it wasn't at all obvious that it was all going to hang together. Obviously, not all of what was, colonized British India did hang together. Obviously, Pakistan became a separate country, but it's actually incredible that that didn't happen in many different regions. And it was this enormous project, in the 40s of convincing all these different princely states that comprise the country to either through cajoling or through threats of violence in some cases to join this new project. And there were a lot of naysayers in those early years who thought that, it wouldn't last long, and it's actually incredible that it has held together for as long as it has. But it's actually a really unlikely project because it's really, India is in a lot of ways more comparable to Europe than it is to most other countries. That it's all these different states really hanging together in this confederation with incredible differences in language, culture, and everything that comes with all that stuff.
That's a very helpful analogy. It's hard to imagine people more different than the Greeks and the Dutch.
Right, exactly. Imagine if they shared a country. And the European Union has kind of given it this quasi state condition, but yeah, not the same thing.
In some ways, the United States could be said the same thing.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. But just that sure, even the language diversity alone across India, it's really without compare. People know that Hindi is the predominant language in India, but it's actually a minority language. Fewer than half of Indians even speak it.
And yet it's the language of government, isn't it?
And there's a lot of controversy over that, over what should be considered official languages. There's always been lots of debate over that, to put it mildly.
Well, understandably.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, that's very difficult for me to imagine that people, I mean, it's, frankly, there are times when any kind of government authority becomes irritating, but at least they speak a language that I kind of sort of understand. I mean, it's bureaucratese, but you can unpack it and get basically what they're on about. But if they were speaking in an entirely different language, making decisions about my life, that would be very disconcerting. I can see why people get upset about that.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And then there's been a push, especially from the right wing, to make Hindi a national uniform language. And of course, this is met with great resistance in the South and many other regions who perceive it, I think, correctly as an effort to sideline regional voices and perspectives, and to actively homogenize the country.
Well, I have to say, one of the aspects of India that I found quite startling was when we were in Kerala and found out that the communists are fairly well established there. And
Yeah, very successful.
I think an elected official was with the Communist Party.
Oh yeah, in fact, it's they've pretty much every other election in Kerala, it flips from the Communist to the Congress Party. And in fact, they're on a streak right now. The Communists have been in power a couple terms in a row. They're probably, in practice closer to Social Democrats, in Europe than maybe than Maoists, for example.
Right, right.
But yeah, it's been said that they're in the Kerala Communists were the first democratically elected Communist Party in the world, when they first came to power. But yeah, they've been going strong there ever since. And a lot of people, credit the Communist Party, at least in part, with a lot of the really strong development indicators that Kerala has. It's got really high literacy, really high standard of living compared to a lot of other places in India, really low infant mortality, all this stuff. It's clearly a complex mix of things, but a lot of people credit some of these Communist Party policies for helping make that happen.
So perhaps it's closer to socialism than communism in the sense of China or Russia.
Yeah, I would say, like when at their rallies they carry around pictures of Stalin and Lenin, but in practice it's more of a my perception is that it's more a socialist approach. But yeah, I mean, a huge thing was, Kerala was an incredibly stratified society before independence. In fact, it probably had the worst form of the caste system in all of India. It was described in the 19th century as a madhouse of caste because it was so horribly stratified along caste lines, and the lower caste and Dalit communities were so oppressed in Kerala. And maybe that's why there was such a strong backlash, like a progressive backlash, because it was so bad. It was also very feudalist, and landowners just, there were these mass landowners who just controlled the state. And like when the communists came in, they instituted really radical land reforms and really did a lot of land distribution. Obviously, there was a lot of resistance to it at the time among the landowners, but it seems to have really paid off in the long run and led to, certainly not a perfectly egalitarian society, but much, much less income inequality than even a lot of other Indian states.
Yeah, it seemed at least from our superficial perspective, a very different culture than Madurai, as an example.
Oh yeah. Even other southern states, 'cause yeah, Madurai is not even far. It's a
No.
neighboring state of Tamil Nadu, but it's still yeah, Kerala's got quite a distinct culture from Tamil Nadu.
And the most obvious difference between India and the West, that doesn't appear to be any social safety net. Is that true?
Actually, there's a lot of, it just kind of takes different forms. There are a lot of social programs for sure. But yeah, they tend to take different forms and they tend to be implemented in different ways because it's a federalist system and there's a huge range in how states approach things. It's hard to speak in broad terms about the social safety net. It's always hard to speak in broad terms about anything in India
Yeah.
because, like, this is like I've heard it said before. I forget who said it, but that there's nothing you can say about India where you can't also say the opposite, and both are true.
This is Open Book. My guest is Rollo Romick, who has spent the past 12 years reporting on South India. He's based in Bangalore, together with his wife and her family. India, with a population of over 1 billion people, is now the most populous country in the world, and at least to those of us on the outside, often the most confounding. Mr. Romig's book, I Am on the Hit List, tells the story of the life and assassination of a journalist, Gauri Lankesh, who was based in Bangalore. But at the same time, it attempts to contextualize that assassination by writing about the shift in the politics of the country toward the autocratic right wing as represented by the Prime Minister, Narendra Modi. This is Mr. Romig reading an excerpt from the beginning.
When I landed back in Bangalore in January 2018, 4 months after Gowri's death, the first person I met was Kavita Lankesh, Gowri's younger sister by 3 years. She looks quite like Gowri, the same wide smile, the same light eyes, but more athletic and with long black hair. Her neighborhood, Chikalasandra, is not too far from Gowri's, but is distinctly more upscale. Kavita is a film director, and as we settled into her living room, a room both stylish and cozy, with one red wall, a skylight, and an uyale, or bench swing, hanging from the ceiling, she told me that she'd just finished a very Enid Blyton-ish kids movie called Summer Holidays, in which Gowri plays a small role as a crusading journalist. "More than my sister, I would say she is my best friend," she said, "my soulmate. We were alike in so many ways." Anything Kavita wrote, she said, she'd show it to Gowri first. If she was torn between making a commercial film and a film that she actually wanted to make, Gowri would give me the courage to follow my heart. Tears flowed silently down her face as she spoke. She cries continuously when she speaks of Gowri, and in the months and years to come, I never saw her pause to collect herself. She just smiles and dries the tears with a tissue as she continues talking, as if already accustomed to the fact that her mourning is a rupture that can never be fixed, only absorbed. "People would always mistake us, her for me, me for her," she said. When she appeared at public events, she said, she was often introduced as a filmmaker, journalist, and activist. She'd try to correct the record and say that she's a filmmaker only, the journalist and activist is her sister, but they'd laugh it off as if she were being overly humble. Eventually, she just let it slide. When Gowri died, some publications ran Kavita's photo with the news. One website, she said, posted Gowri's photo with the words, "Kavita Lankesh is dead." They were different in many ways, too. Gowri was an atheist, while Kavita prays around 5 times a day. "You're like a Muslim," Gowri would tease her. In the wake of her death, many had accused Gowri of being hostile to religion, but Kavita insisted that wasn't true. "They celebrated everything together," she said. "Hindu holidays at their younger brother Indrajit's house, Christmas at Kavita's house, and the Muslim feast of Eid at Gowri's house." Gowri loved explaining the meaning of each festival to Kavita's and Indrajit's children. 3 generations of Lankesh women live in Kavita's house. Kavita, her mother Indira, and her daughter Isha. Isha popped in to introduce herself, a bright-eyed 13-year-old with very long, straight, dark hair. She's an impressive kid and possessed of the preternatural poise of many Indian teenagers. Kavita is a single mother by choice. Isha's father is an American whom Kavita used to date, and when she decided that she wanted to have a child on her own, he agreed to help. Isha calls Kavita Amma and called Gowri Ava. Both mean mother. "Everybody thought that she was Gowri's daughter, actually," Kavita said. Earlier in 2017, Kavita and Gowri got matching forearm tattoos of Isha's name. Kavita's in English letters, and Gowri's in the looping script of Kannada, embellished with a peacock feather. Gowri spent at least a day with them every weekend, no matter how busy things got at the newspaper. Kavita is a vegetarian, but she often cooked meat for Gowri, who liked to say she'd eat anything that walked. She was such a bachelor that she would not cook anything at home, so she took food from here. Every week we'd make curries, chapatis, things like that, and pack them for her. On the night of the murder, when the police inspected Gowri's house, they asked Kavita, "Madam, there is no milk, no nothing. What does she drink or eat?" "She had a constant cough, smoker's cough," she said, "and she didn't do any exercise." Kavita smokes too. It's made her voice husky. I asked her how many cigarettes she goes through a day, and she said, 15 or 30. But Kavita was also a national yoga champion. For a time, she worked as a yoga instructor in New York City, and every day she both works out and walks her dogs 4 kilometers. For Gowri, who smoked even more, climbing the single flight of stairs to her newspaper office was the only exercise she got. I tried to force her to work out at least a bit, Kavita said. Once I remember she did some kind of exercise at home and sent us a sweaty picture of herself. That went on for maybe 15 days. After that, nothing.
So it's always really tricky to make broad assertions about this place.
And to be honest, what comes to mind is Brits I meet. Oh yeah, I've been to the States. Oh really? Yeah, and you know they start waxing knowledgeable about something they clearly don't know very much about at all, because they, as I did with India, they just visited, and so it's really easy to make these snap judgments when you don't have anything to challenge them.
Yeah.
What else going with that? So it struck me, thinking about your book, that reviewers have said things along the lines of, well, this is a profile of a journalist as a way to profile a country.
Yeah.
But it seems to me that it's equally a very personal story.
That's true, you know. This is, you know, this is a place that I became really invested in, just spending a lot of time there. And I was interested in writing about how much the country's changed over the past 10 years, you know, with the, particularly with the rise of the right wing there, as in so many other places, just because I found it distressing, really, to see how much the country had changed and to see that this pluralist vision of India is being really actively dismantled. So yeah, that was something that I really wanted to describe. But you know, it was really important to tell it through the story of one person and of specific places. Yeah.
The number of people who read newspapers in India is greater than any other country in the world. The statistic was 20,000 newspapers in 180 languages.
Oh yeah, I mean, just as we've seen, you know, newspapers completely collapse everywhere, still a really loyal newspaper reading country. I mean, it's declined, you know, it's declined in India too. It's hard for it not to with the rise of smartphones, which of course everyone has in India also. But yeah, they've definitely held on to their newspaper traditions a lot longer than virtually anyone else. And there's just this incredible proliferation of just different kinds of newspapers and in yeah, every language possible. And yeah, really, it's funny, you go around, you find out just how much people read the paper, you know, like when my wife and I got married, you know, almost 16 years ago, they had an item about it in this local paper in Kerala. I don't know why, but they sent a journalist out to talk to us at our wedding. And then it was so funny because then for a couple of days afterwards, we kept running to people on the street saying like, oh, are you Rala? We read about your marriage in the paper. We're like, wow, it really shows how many people are reading the newspaper. Even my sister, she was in Kerala for the wedding, and she was riding an auto rickshaw, and the rickshaw driver turned and said, she mentioned that she was there for a wedding, and he was like, oh, is it Rallo? Like, you know, I wasn't even there for that one. Very committed newspaper readers. And it was fun just to dive into that whole world. Of people who passionately write for and people who passionately read these newspapers and magazines, you know, including the subject of the book, Gauri Lankesh. She was, you know, the editor of this tabloid paper, and her father, P. Lankesh, was one of the most influential tabloid publishers. Both of them wrote in this language, Kannada, which is the predominant language of Karnataka, the state where the Bangalore is the capital of. And yeah, he, you know, he was already a famous writer, her father, before he started this paper. And he wrote in every form, you know, short stories, poems, plays. And then he started this paper, though, and I've never heard of a paper that was more beloved by its readers, people who I talked to. It ran from 1980 to 2000 when he died. And people would just wait at the newsstand till the new copy came. It was like the highlight of their week was to get a copy of this paper. And you can see why, because there was just nothing really like it. It was he, you know, when he came along and started this paper in 1980, it was the journalistic scene in Karnataka was pretty buttoned down. Newspapers tend to be pretty formal. He wasn't like that at all. He was like a punk rocker in journalism, you know? And so he came out and he was rude. He was sensationalistic. He insulted politicians freely, and came up with insulting nicknames for them. But at the same time, his paper was very high-minded, and it kind of like brought the literature of the world to Karnataka, in translation. So it was this really exciting mix of high and low, and people couldn't get enough of it. Just had a huge influence on both the politics of the state and the literature of the state that really resounds today still. And just there's been dozens of copycat tabloids that have been published in the years since in Karnataka. So just a really exciting figure. And it's fun, you know, it's just fun. It was fun to dig into that in this time when, you know, print journalism is declining in most places, just to get a reminder of what it looks like when it really thrives.
It sounds a bit like you're describing Rolling Stone in its early days.
In some ways,
It had
yeah.
that same kind of impact on my life, anyway.
Yeah, exactly. No,
The
it
specific.
reminds me of how I've heard people describe like the early years of that magazine. Yeah, for
Yeah,
sure.
20,000 newspapers in 180 languages, over 180 languages.
Yeah, could you imagine?
Yes.
Yeah.
No, I can't. I can't even begin. But then, having said that, when you were in London, you will notice on any candy store or whatever, at the airport or in the train stations or whatever, there's like seven daily newspapers in London
Yeah.
that run the gamut, and it covers the political spectrum. Those newspapers,
Yeah. Yeah.
people will say, "Oh, you read The Guardian."
Yeah.
You're marked from that point on, you know.
Well, unfortunately, you know, the situation in India is that even as this, it's almost a little misleading because even as, you know, print journalism still thrives, freedom of the press has really plummeted. You know, the current government has really actively gone after journalists and puts a lot of pressure on journalists. Both, you know, everything from direct calls to their editors to tell them to stop covering certain things or stop saying certain things. And if they don't, you know, agree to go along with the government program, there's often tax raids on newsrooms, and then often journalists are being charged with crimes, sometimes charged with terrorism, just for doing journalism. The charges don't even make sense, but they're not even trying to make sense a lot of the time. It's especially Muslim journalists who are targeted with these absurd terrorism charges. So sometimes, you know, you can go to India and you can see these full newsstands and you can see people reading newspapers everywhere, and it feels like the press is still flourishing, but it's actually really in crisis, and it's really hard to speak freely in the press. And again, this varies a lot regionally. In a state like Kerala, you'll see a lot, the press is a lot less restricted. In other places, it's a lot tougher to say things. But yeah, it's actually become a really, really tough environment to do journalism.
This is Open Book. My guest is Rollo Romig, who has lived for the past 13 years in Bangalore in South India. He's been covering the country. His recent book, I Am on the Hit List, is about a journalist working for a paper she owned in Bangalore. The journalist Gauri Lankesh was assassinated. The book is about that assassination, while at the same time it is an attempt to contextualize the work she was doing within a rapidly changing country led by a right-leaning autocratic Prime Minister Narendra Modi and his BJP Hindu party. Everything you've just said kind of contradicts the idea of a country that's hanging together. You're talking about Kerala as ignoring what I guess we could call the feds, pressuring them not to do. To go back, the person at the center of your story is Gauri, is that how you pronounce it?
That's right. Yeah, Gauri, yeah.
Gauri Lankesh. And as you said, her father ran a newspaper that one person described as a combination of the New Yorker and the New York Post, which I think is... Let's think about that for a second. You know, is that possible to manage that?
Exactly. Yeah, so it makes it exciting.
So then his daughter has started a newspaper, but she didn't have the same impact.
Yeah, that's true. You know, it's he was kind of a one of a kind. So after he died, she took over the paper. And you know, its readership definitely declined under her editorship, partly because her interests kind of went in different directions. She became interested. She was certainly interested in running the paper and was passionately committed to it. But her interest went in a more activist direction. She'd been a much, you know, before she took over her father's paper in the year 2000, she was writing in English for the most part for like big English language periodicals, magazines, and doing pretty, you know, conventional mainstream reporting and with a pretty conventional approach, sticking to a neutral position when she wrote about things. And really the experience of taking over her father's paper, and especially in writing in Kannada, and I think a lot of it was just knowing who she was writing for. Because when you're writing in English in India, your audience is vague. They could be anywhere. They're not really set in a particular geography. The English language media has a lot of influence, but its readership is actually quite small compared to all the other languages. When you're writing in another language, in an Indian language, you know a lot more specifically who your audience is. You're a lot more connected to them. And that has an effect on you. And it had a huge effect on her. It really radicalized her to get involved in an intimate level with the specific problems of Karnataka and of Bangalore. And the change it made in her was it made her really want to abandon a kind of neutral or objective viewpoint. And she said, you know what, this is always, she went to journalism school. This is drilled into you in journalism school that you maintain, you know, an objective stance. And she kind of made the decision, no, I reject this position, that actually to be objective is a false position because it's really an endorsement of the status quo. And she started describing herself as a journalist activist, and then later kind of flipped that equation, called herself an activist journalist. So even as she was completely devoted and pouring, you know, endless hours into the paper, she was equally devoting time to her activism. And that was, you know, and she saw them as kind of one and the same. And so even if the circulation of her paper was small, what was important to her was that she was organizing around various causes behind the scenes, giving a lot of speeches. Even people who were close to her didn't realize how big her influence and how kind of big her network had become until she died, because it was subtle and it was behind the scenes. You know, her paper had a small circulation by the time she died. It was in danger of folding. She was kind of scrambling to get the money together in the last week before she died. But then when she was killed, Tens of thousands of people came out in the streets of Bangalore, not just because they were shocked by her murder, which they were. People actually protested in many Indian cities, but those Bangalore protests happened because she knew so many people and connected with so many people. This was something that right off the bat really interested me about her. Because, when she was murdered, it made international news all over the world because it was so shocking that this, unarmed woman was shot alone on her doorstep in Bangalore, a city that has virtually no gun crime usually. So just the shock and the mystery of that became international news. But it was kind of assumed that she was famous because she was a major journalist. And as soon as I started looking into it, I was like, I think she was an absolutely remarkable one of a kind person. But what made her interesting was kind of misunderstood. And even people who are close to her were kind of catching up on what made this person just connect with so many people. Why did tens of thousands of people come out, like from so many different populations, who, she meant something to them? Everything, Muslims, Hindus, street sweepers, trans people, all felt like they just had a connection with her and a stake in her life. So the book is so much about trying to crack the mystery of who killed her. That's a big part of it. It's a police procedural in a lot of ways. But I'm also, if anything, what really sustained me over the years that I worked on it was trying to unravel the mystery of who she was as a person and how she went about living her life and what she found worth doing in life. It was something I'd learned a lot from myself on a personal level of just like, because we're used to, when we identify people's talents, we're used to thinking of them along the lines of what their profession is, and since her job title was journalist, people assumed that that was her primary talent was in journalism. And it's not to say that she wasn't a talented journalist, but I think that what made her extraordinary was her talent for friendship, her talent for connecting with people, her talent for ringing the alarm when really dangerous things are starting to happen in the country. And even though people called her alarmist, they thought that she was exaggerating. She was actually right about everything. And all these things are they're these skills that don't really come with job titles, and so we don't really know how to think about them. And we don't even necessarily think of them as talents, like a talent for ringing the alarm, a talent for friendship. These are real skills that people have to hone over time, but we don't really have the vocabulary for that stuff. That really interested me a lot.
No, I can see why. That is interesting because, first of all, the way you're describing her as a person sounds a lot like her dad, that she had
Yeah,
similar skills to her father.
that's true, and they did have a lot in common.
Her attitude toward journalism may have been a little different, and that was why perhaps she didn't have as many readers, but at the same time, she had her father's charismatic appeal. People liked her.
She just interested people, and she certainly learned a lot. I mean, he was definitely an unconventional journalist. She learned a lot from him, like just the fact that like he would never write. If he was writing about a crime in his paper, he would never put the word allegedly on it, even if it hadn't been proven in court. So she followed suit on that. Her attitude was, if someone's a scoundrel, you call him a scoundrel. Let my lawyer sort it out. She got a lot of trouble for that too, but that was something she definitely got from her father. She didn't have kind of like the once in a generation literary talent that he definitely had. But yeah, she definitely a lot of what made him an extraordinary and even an outrageous person rubbed off on her.
So there's this sort of contrast in that this is a relatively small town paper. I think the population of Bangalore is 12 million, is that right?
So it's this mega city. And Bangalore is such a weird contradiction because you go there and it doesn't, aside from the traffic, which is abysmal, it's actually the worst traffic in the whole world, according to people who study traffic, the worst gridlock of any city in the world. Other than that, It doesn't feel like a mega city. It's still got this kind of laid back quality. It's bewildering to people who live there for a long time because it really just blew up. It just like doubled and doubled and doubled again in size because of this tech boom that really only started in the 80s, you know? And so people who've lived there longer than that, they grew up in what they thought of as just like a sleepy town that barely got mentioned. And then now it's this, you know, now it's this mega city that's famous the world over. And it's still got qualities of both, you know. That's a lot of actually what I love about the city is this weird tension between it being this like international mega city and just like this really sleepy, quirky, charming town, you know. Yeah, that's what kind of kept me coming back, you know, even before I was working on this book.
So that doesn't, and I guess my point in saying that was that that doesn't really explain what happened.
No.
You cited the statistic, which is really chilling, that 42 journalists have been murdered in India since 1992, and
Yeah, and
only
I'm sure the
three of
number is
them have,
higher now. That was at the time I published the book,
and
yeah.
only three convictions out of those 42 murders. So for the most part, those murders went unsolved.
Yeah. And you know,
And that
yeah.
leaves the question. So there's three things really.
Yeah.
So there's this threat apparently toward somebody who has the ability to organize that kind of, well, it's a kind of terrorist organization built of
Yeah.
cells where the people within the cells don't necessarily know each other and they don't know anything about each other. So it's highly organized. It's basically an assassination cartel. That's the way I understood it.
Yeah, I think that's
Why
right,
did they
but
focus on this young woman? Well, she went young. This lady in her 50s running
yeah.
relatively small newspapers, not doing very well anyway. Why do they feel the need to shoot this woman? That's the question. And then the other question, which seems interesting to me, is why is it that she was shot in a place where it's so hard to get a gun? How do you even organize that kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, well, it does take a lot of organization. It takes a lot of work to pull off an assassination like this. That was one of the things that, you know, that baffled investigators at first. Who pulled it off and how did they remain undetected for so long? There was a lot of planning that went into this. They ultimately charged 18 people for conspiring to kill her, arrested 17. One of them is still on the run. They haven't caught him. It's, you know, they came largely from out of state. Some of the conspirators were in the city helping them organize things, but the main conspirators actually came from outside the state. And why did they kill her? It's one of the big mysteries. It's, you know, it's by their own telling, in sort of the evidence that they left behind and in the statements that they gave to police after they were arrested, it seemed that they killed her more or less for blasphemy, you know, for offending their idea, this very orthodox political version of what Hinduism should be. And it's important to say that they're not representative of kind of Hindu attitudes broadly. You know, they came definitely from this fringe movement. The kind of brand of Hinduism they come from is often referred to as Hindutva, which is really a politicized right-wing approach to Hinduism and not at all synonymous with the religion at large. But it's this project, you know, to try to homogenize the religion and to try to narrow it along these political nationalistic lines and really to turn India, which is this incredibly diverse country in many ways, but not least religiously, to turn it into an explicitly Hindu country where, you know, Muslims and Christians and every other religion are explicitly second-class citizens. And they've made a lot of progress in this project under the BJP. You know, this group that killed Gauri was from a fringe group that has no direct affiliation with the government, except their political aims are actually pretty much synonymous. So are they really fringe when what they believe in on a political level is so close to what the government endorses? But yeah, and it's important to say, you know, like this project of ostracizing non-Hindus, it's incredibly far-reaching. I mean, India's got one of the biggest Muslim populations in the world. It's actually got more Muslims than Pakistan. Because even though Muslims are just 10% of the population in India, that's it's over 100 million people. So it's a big deal when a populate when a religious it's the biggest religious minority in the world. And when a religious minority that large is being so systematically ostracized, it's a huge impact. But it's easy to ignore because they're kind of hidden away in this vast country. That was one of her biggest concerns. As a journalist and an activist, is what was happening to Muslims and what was happening, in India the term is communalization, this kind of hostility, segregation, and often violence along religious lines. She was really alarmed about how that was going, and that was one of the things that she was really raising the alarm bell about. It seems that, the men who killed her, it seems like what really bothered them the most was that she'd spoken really flippantly about Hinduism in a speech. And she did have this tendency to speak really flippantly about religion. She was an atheist. She didn't, by her own admission, she didn't really understand religion, she didn't understand why people believed in things, and she sometimes could speak pretty dismissively and sometimes pretty rudely about people's religious belief. And sometimes even to a degree that made her own colleagues uncomfortable, and like fellow atheists uncomfortable. But obviously no one deserves violence even for saying rude things. And it's interesting, these guys who killed her, they seemed fixated on people who said rude things about religion with this idea that like these people have to be taken out because they're doing irreparable harm to the religion. And really obsessed with this idea of blasphemy, which interestingly is not a traditional Hindu concept. There's nothing in the Hindu scriptures about blasphemy. It's really an Abrahamic idea, so it's interesting that they took that on.
This is Open Book. My guest is Rollo Romig, an American journalist based in Bangalore in South India. His book, just recently published and nominated for a Pulitzer, called I Am on the Hit List, is nominally about the life and assassination of a journalist in Bangalore called Gauri Lankesh. But it's also equally about the political shift in the country toward the right under the auspices of the BJP party, which represents the Hindu population of the country. Perhaps we should back up for a second. So there are two essential parties in India, as I understand it, the Congress Party, which is left-leaning. Is that true to say that?
I guess kind of vaguely. I mean, I wouldn't really call them leftist. I think they've become more of a centrist party. I mean, maybe more accurate to call them an opportunist party, because they'll take Hindutva positions if it serves them in a particular election. You kind of don't know what you're going to get with the Congress Party. There's some certainly not true for everyone in Congress, but I think it's there's no doubt that the party has diminished substantially since its glorious early days as being really the Independence Party, the party that fought the most prominently for any independence, the party of Gandhi and Nehru. Well, I guess probably like every party that starts as a revolutionary independence movement, it's inevitably becomes diminished over the years once it actually takes power.
Well, it sounds as if they were trying to incorporate what, as you've said, is a very diverse country.
Yes,
That
well,
appeals.
that's definitely true. The Congress Party has always been far more committed to this idea of a pluralist India, and that pluralism is the fundamental Indian idea. And the BJP and all of their related organizations absolutely reject that idea, that pluralism is even a value.
And the BJP is led by this man, Narendra Modi,
That's right. Who's now
who,
been prime minister for over 10 years. He's in his third term.
to be honest with you, Rollo, until I read your book, I knew his name, and that was about it. But you described him, and I think it is an interesting comparison as a charismatic populist à la Trump. And then the quote is a majoritarian strongman who never apologizes
That's right.
and has a
That's right.
very rigid, as you said, at least in name, Hindu-centered administration. He wants to create a theocracy, in effect.
Yeah, and in a lot of ways has succeeded, where he's actually been like he presides over major religious rituals as prime minister. So when you see him doing this stuff, you have to wonder, is it already in some ways a theocracy when the prime minister behaves this way? He has a lot in common with Trump for sure, in particular with their kind of right-wing populist approach. There's this network really of right-wing populist leaders that we have in the world now, and Trump and Modi are certainly see a kinship in each other. The difference with Modi is he's actually in a lot of ways a much more talented politician than Trump is. Trump's obviously talented enough to have won the presidency twice, but Modi knows how to get his agenda done in a way that Trump's more of a chaos agent. He kind of flails around and makes big moves, and some of them stick and some of them don't. Modi is a much, much shrewder and smarter political operative, which in a lot of ways makes him a lot more dangerous because he knows how to implement his agenda, and he's done it.
That's the impression I had too, and you also described him as very articulate and
Oh, yes.
a very charismatic figure.
Yes, absolutely.
And one of the perhaps this is one of the hallmarks of his mode of government. He shut down the internet far more often, quote, than any other government in the world, which is to, I don't want people talking in ways that I can't control, I guess is what that means, right?
Exactly. And especially in Kashmir, anytime that there's a hint of a flare up there, internet gets shut down.
So we have a very powerful a man who brags about having a 52-inch chest,
Yeah.
a la Putin, and in some ways he sounds
Yes.
more like Putin than Trump.
Yeah, I think they have a lot in common too. Yeah, for sure.
A strong man who is widely admired, and yet the impression I had was that while they have been successful, you saw it as a short-term success.
Know.
The tide is turning against them or not?
I actually wouldn't say so, They I mean, I hope that the flame is being kept alive for the pluralist India that I admire, but I think they've been incredibly successful. I think they've changed attitudes, even kind of altered the geography of where people live in India, in terms of segregating populations in a way that's going to be hard to change. I think there's if there's a reversal, it's going to take an enormous amount of work. I mean, he certainly made a lot more big dramatic moves in his second term than he is in his third term. My sense of it, though, is that because he basically succeeded in his agenda in the second term. So I certainly have hope. And like I said, India is such a diverse set of viewpoints that not just one flame, but many different flames are always being kept alive there. But it takes a lot of bravery, it takes a lot of work. To keep standing up against an authoritarian regime that's as powerful and successful as this one is.
Do you plan to continue living in Bangalore?
Well, I haven't been living there. I've spent a lot of time there. I'll usually, in years past, I've often gone there for, a month or so at a time. But yeah, I hope to keep coming back. I love the place as much as I ever have.
Okay, so I think I misunderstood. So your wife doesn't live in Bangalore. She lives here.
No, we're actually in New York City now. Yeah.
Ah, gotcha. And what about
Yeah.
the rest of her family? Are they here in the States or are they still in Bangalore?
No. They're probably some of them are in India, some are in Dubai. Yeah.
How is it for the people you know living in Bangalore? Has life become very different for them?
It's interesting. It kind of depends on who you ask. I think it is I feel like this is one of the big things that I've learned from writing this book, and that now I'm seeing unfold here in the US, that when your country loses its democracy, and I think that it's not inaccurate to say that there's been a substantial decline of democracy in both India and the US. I think there's an argument to be made that both countries have lost their democracy in real ways. That it's what I learned is that it's easy for that to happen, but to not really fully notice that it's happened, which is not really what how I thought these things worked before I started looking at it. You know, I guess, you know, those of us who live in countries that are democracies under threat, we're kind of waiting for like a switch to turn where it's like obvious that we're living in an autocracy, and it's obvious that our democracy isn't fully there anymore. And that switch doesn't really happen. No one's going to come along and tell you definitively you flipped over. You know, day-to-day life goes on much the same. And so it's really easy to convince yourself that things are still basically okay. Until it comes to your doorstep. And it usually doesn't come to your doorstep unless you are actively pushing back against this slide into autocracy, or unless you're from a targeted group. And so I think if you ask Muslims in India how things are now, you're going to get a very different answer than if you ask Hindus in India, even very well-meaning, sympathetic liberal Hindus, I think often don't grasp how bad things have gotten for their Muslim neighbors. I think it's very similar here in the US. It's, you know, it's kind of a full-time job to fully tune in and understand just how bad things have gotten, you know? And most of us don't have the time for that. And when we do have the time, it's actually really depressing to spend all your time reading bad news in the newspaper. Not to mention the fact that one of the hallmarks of an autocracy is they suppress what's even said in the newspapers. So it's hard to get a complete picture of what's happening. But
Certainly,
yeah.
that's the case in India.
Yeah.
You said
So,
in
you
the book that
know,
most of the newspapers are hardly worth reading anymore.
and, you know, at least from a perspective of getting like honest political news. And so, precisely because, you know, there's just as many news channels as there were before, there's almost as many newspapers as there were before, it can feel like the press is th still thriving when it's absolutely not in really important ways.
The book by my guest Rollo Romig, nominated for a Pulitzer Prize, is titled I Am on the Hit List. This is Open Book. I'm Richard Wynnum. Thanks so much for listening.